This is the Future of Water, where we talk about all the ways which companies, utilities, and people are addressing the challenges and opportunities in water. Today, we're going to talk with Bluefield consultant Greg Goodwin about the Biden administration's proposal to finally deal with America's chronic lead problem. Yep. It's going to be a good conversation because, quite honestly, I know what he's going to talk about. It's really interesting in our preparation. So stay tuned for that. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit of news as we do at the Future Water Podcast. So number one, NW Natural Company, water company that has recently completed two acquisitions and signed three additional agreements to acquire utilities near its existing service territories. NW Natural is clearly building out its water position, at least demonstrating it through these acquisitions and agreements. The acquisitions include two systems, one in Idaho and one in Washington. The other agreements are in Idaho, Texas, and Washington. So why we like this at Bluefield? One, it's a traditional gas services provider or critical infrastructure player building out its water footprint, which actually only began a few years ago. So as outsiders looking in seek opportunities in the water sector, NW Natural seems to be doing it. They've figured out a strategy, and it's not like they're just doing it in Oregon or within their gas territory. They're actually going much further afield into places like Texas, which seeing a lot more activity. One, there are a lot of systems, a lot of small systems at that, but also there's fair market value legislation, and there's going to be increasing stress on small systems. So look out for companies like NW Natural continuing to grow as an investor-owned water utility. Number two, Veolia has agreed to acquire Suez, or better yet, another way to put it, Suez has finally agreed to let Veolia take the remaining 71% equity in the company after a long disputed takeover, which was unsolicited at that. The two groups have been at this, I think, since August 2020. Feels longer than that. So it's been about 8 months. When Veolia originally acquired 29.9% of Suez at about 18 euros a share from Engie. So over this time, you know, Suez has pushed back in a number of different ways. It's pushed back by press releases, poison pills, and it's also entertained offers from other suitors. Maybe that was a straw man of sorts, but they're still involved in another way because Veolia raised its offer price and pledged to sell back a bigger share of the French water rival just to maintain competitive balance. I think there was probably going to be some antitrust issues, and not just in France, but some other European as well as, I believe Australia is on there as well. But the deal closes 14th of May, gives Suez an equity value of about $15 billion total. So the combined entity will have, I think, total revenues of about 37 billion euros. So it's a huge deal for the water sector. Is it the biggest deal? Getting close to it. If not, I think it probably is. But it's also interesting because the water sector is so fragmented. It's definitely filled with a lot of small deals. So the big ones are definitely out there, and this is really interesting. And it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. And for that reason, I'm trying to nail down my colleague, Keith Hayes. We've talked about this on other Future Water podcasts, the Veolia Suez deal, but we'd like to sort of see if we can circle back and talk about what this really means, not only for the two companies, but also for the water market as a whole. Number three, a little bit different. Japan has announced plans to release treated wastewater from the Fukushima nuclear plant into the ocean, which is going to take place over a couple of years. The water was originally tainted or poisoned from the nuclear facility after the earthquake and tsunami in 2011. Japan insists that the water is safe. Hey, the guys, there's nothing to worry about. And it also has support from the International Atomic Energy Association. But as you can imagine, as I think everybody probably should be, China and South Korea are also concerned. I mean, they're its closest neighbors and they're wondering what's going to happen to the water. So Japan plans to release more than, I think, 1 million metric tons of the water as it does this. So I guess everybody should eat your sushi now and see what happens in a couple of years. So be safe out there with whatever you eat, I guess. So that wraps up the news. And what I do want to remind everybody is you can always sign up for the Waterline newsletter. You can do that at bluefieldresearch.com. Sign up. Every Wednesday, you're going to get a newsletter that one gives you a couple news items. I think it's typically three, gives you some data or at least data insights on what's happening, at least that our analysts think is interesting. And you get access to other things like discounts and other information as Bluefield releases it. We have a lot of content, not only archived, but also coming out over the next couple of months. So there's no better time than now to sign up for the newsletter. But as I will say this at the end, you can also sign up for the Future Water podcast. You'll get some insights there too. All right, enough of that. More importantly, let's jump into the conversation with Greg Goodwin. He has some really good insights. So let's get to it. So I'm joined here today by Greg Goodwin. So Greg, how's it going?
Going pretty well, Reese. How you doing?
I'm making it, you know. It's I guess we're almost towards the end of the week. So weekend's coming. And then I guess you're in Massachusetts too, so we get Patriots Day off, which is next week, right?
Yeah, that's right. Although no requisite marathon to usually go with it, but any Monday that's off is a good Monday to be off, I guess.
I have no idea. Are they still going to have a baseball game at 11 a.m. like they usually do?
I don't know. I don't know what the deal with that is. I haven't checked. It's been a weird year for following sports in general, but that's something to look for, I guess.
I mean, not that anybody else really cares about Patriots Day if you're outside of New England, but for those who want to be in the know, it's Lexington and Concord, and it's the day that everybody takes off, and it's usually a big celebration, which is kind of in spirit has evolved over the past couple of years, particularly since the marathon bombing. But nonetheless, I think the marathon's going to happen in the fall. Columbus Day, Indigenous Peoples Day, not sure what we're calling it these days, but I don't know what that'll look like. Everybody gets that day off too, so we'll celebrate then as well. So look, Greg, as we talked about ramping up to this, I think it's finally infrastructure week. So it seems at least more tangible. And admittedly, the Biden plan, as it's been laid out, is the American Jobs Plan. That's another way to put it, is a wish list. But one thing that stands out, it's about $45 billion explicitly laid out to tackle lead service lines. And for so long, no one has wanted to really pay for this. No one's known how to pay for it, which kind of points to a couple of questions I have for you. But, and there's been no documentation about the size of the problem. But hey, the world is bright now. We're coming out of a pandemic. We got infrastructure week. That is until Mitch McConnell gets hold of the proposal. So, what's your take, generally speaking?
Yeah, I mean, so it sounds like, as to your point there, that this is sort of becoming more of a reality and less of kind of a weekly thing to call a week by the end of the Friday. So in terms of the lead service lines, you're definitely right. It's a massive problem that's had plenty of national attention over the last few years. The case in Flint certainly being probably the most prominent case of the issues that can arise from having lead in the water. So kind of on a high level, there's still millions of lead service lines in the ground that have been there over the last several decades, depending on, you know, when the infrastructure was put in place. And, you know, this is a market that we're estimating to be somewhere in the area of around $32 billion nationally to remediate in some way. So pretty serious money, pretty widespread problem. If you want to look at in general, kind of where the worst problem areas are, it tends to track, you know, where some of the older infrastructure in the country is. So Midwest and Northeast are some highlights. In particular, states like Illinois, Michigan, Pennsylvania, New Jersey are examples of areas that have had some pretty high profile examples of lead service line issues in recent years. Newark and Trenton in New Jersey. The area around Chicago and Illinois is one of the highest concentrations known in terms of the lines in the ground right now and kind of a growing issue in that area. So, you know, there are national implications for this money and for updates to the lead and copper rule that are being rolled out by EPA or in the process of being rolled out. But those are kind of the key areas that will probably be the most impacted.
Do we know, you know, you mentioned sort of the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic over through the Midwest, or, you know, largely the Rust Belt. And honestly, I mean, it's a lot of older cities, older housing stock, dense populations. What about like the West and other, even the South? Is there any indication of lead service lines in those states as well of any scale?
Yeah, there's no particular area of the country that is not affected to some degree. But I think to your point there, you know, there is a strong correlation with age of infrastructure. The lead service line ban for putting in the ground was as recently as 1986 on the federal level. So it's something that is sort of lagging even from kind of some of the 70s era bans on lead in terms of paint or in gasoline that are not so far in the distant past of lead kind of being in the life of consumer products or in people's homes and so forth. So it's something that affects everywhere, but it does have kind of a relation to how old some of the infrastructure is in some of the, you know, older parts of the country, as far as when homes were built, when the underground pipes were put in place and so forth. So that's one of the reasons where we tend to see it more in kind of the Rust Belt and Northeast, as you say.
But I think one thing to point out, if it's not evident to the listeners, is that it's not really a utility problem per se. You know, we're not really talking about water mains specifically in sort of the traditional utility network, which is on their side of the meter, water meter, that is. It's really on the residential side, the homeowner, correct?
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the large challenges, particularly with the rollout of these new updates in the lead and copper rule, is there's going to be sort of an inventory requirement on the part of utilities to understand everything that's kind of in the ground within their sort of jurisdiction. And to your point, one of the largest questions that we see utilities kind of asking is how to deal with that issue of kind of the public side of the LSL, which leads up to the curb stop, and then the private side, and how to understand everything that's in the ground. And there's a pretty wide range of knowledge in terms of what utilities know of how that information was gathered, whether this was done very long ago and it was on tap cards or sort of an analog method. How well was that done at the time? And was that transferred over faithfully to a computer system in the 80s or wherever that would have been? So there's a pretty wide range of knowledge of what's in the ground across some of these utilities that's going to be a challenge in the next several years.
Yeah, I mean, in all fairness to utilities, I know probably even a Bluefield, but in general, you know, they catch a lot of grief for not having good control of their, you know, asset inventory. But in this case, or in many cases, when it comes to lead service lines, they're in many respects not responsible for it, yet they're being held accountable, which has been the big issue about who's going to pay for this. So I guess the question is, what are we going to do about it, or what can be done? What are the steps of the process in planning?
Right. So with the updates, the kind of the general thrust of some of these updates to the lead and copper rule is to attempt to make things more proactive and transparent as far as kind of actions. So, you know, I mentioned sort of the inventory management piece there. There is kind of a push in industry now to using information technology tools to help with this predictive modeling, kind of probabilistic modeling that can take different data such as kind of age of infrastructure and other sort of inputs to construct a model of the likelihood of where lead service lines would exist based on a number of different inputs. So that's kind of a recent development in terms of handling sort of the knowledge management part of the problem, and also allocating resources for if you need to dig up the lines. Another is around the additional sampling requirements and public reporting part of the rule that will be required, which also kind of play into the information management portion of this. There's a new requirement around sampling in schools and childcare facilities and reporting of those results, which kind of similar to what you're talking about before, of this is something a private side of the line not being the utility's historical responsibility. There's an area here in terms of now where utilities might have some sort of jurisdictional overlap with how schools sample and being compliant in where and how frequently they sample for lead in the water and how that gets reported to the public. So it's another area where the information management, data management component of things is going to be probably a larger requirement than before. And bringing that sort of that digital piece, whether being developed internally by contractors for the utilities, maybe some of the very advanced utilities have this capability in-house. There's a couple of prominent examples like Denver Water doing a lot of this kind of on their own, but really kind of those companies that are going to be helping them to sort of address this problem across the value chain.
And if I may, I mean, I know we've talked about this, companies like 120 Water and Blue Conduit, I think is another that you've looked at extensively. And I know more about 120 Water, and that is, you know, that was really how they sort of cut their teeth when they got into the water space and launched, was looking at schools or at-risk populations, schools being one, childcare facilities, and that was for monitoring and testing. And now, if anything, they seem to be, 120 and I assume Blue Conduit as well, seem to be in great position given that this is, when it comes to water infrastructure, this is like the most explicit part of the whole American jobs plan. And that's where the dollars seem to be going. Am I correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a well-positioned place to be in terms of timing and so forth, with the spending being proposed, as you mentioned, and also the EPA proposed updates to the lead and copper rule, because to your point there, the school and childcare facility portion of the plan is more explicit with those rules coming out, and the information management component of the rule is going to be more important. So having those capabilities around dashboards, predictive modeling, managing sampling and sort of communication around that is going to be something that's going to be more important to utilities in the next several years as they are kind of forced to come into compliance with this rule. So that's definitely a piece of the puzzle that's going to be more important. And we're hearing that definitely from utilities themselves and, you know, kind of the larger engineering firms that are, you know, historically involved in this kind of work with the corrosion control and the kind of the program management overall. So I think that that's right on in terms of the opportunity for those types of firms to gain market share here.
I was speaking with some of the Bluefield analysts just yesterday, and we were talking about, you know, where does lead versus other emerging contaminants sort of stack up as far as market opportunity. If you had asked, and you know as much about this as anybody at Bluefield, and that is PFAS. And if you had asked, let's say last January, everybody would said, oh, PFAS is a big opportunity. Lead, we've been kicking that can down the road for so long. Is it really going to happen? It's going to be a slow rollout state by state where states are allocating dollars to remediate the problem. Now with this, the real likelihood of lead being sort of the number one opportunity as far as like, I don't know, it's not really an emerging contaminant of concern. It's been around for a long time. So, but a contaminant of concern. So this seems to be where the opportunity is going. But I think the other thing is, you know, so you talked about a little bit about monitoring. You talked about a little bit about inventory. You did. So there are two things. There's kind of the replacement, you know, what is it going to take? And then also the, I guess you mentioned program management, right? I mean, that seems like just because of the sheer volume of replacements, that's going to be huge. Am I correct? As far as nationwide?
Yeah, that there's going to be, I mean, depending on how utilities plan on. So one of the things that the updates add to the rule is a new trigger level around creating a plan for dealing with the lead pipes that are in the ground, where previously it was an action level that was at, I think, 15 parts per billion. And now there's one at 10 in terms of the testing. So the testing requirement itself is more robust in terms of the frequency and how many liters need to be tested before you're kind of all clear. And so with that advancement in the testing regime and with the number of known service lines kind of in existence that are a lead, there's going to be kind of a need to accelerate the removal of some of these lead service lines in various places based on kind of what the results of that testing will likely be. So there are some places I'm sure that are, if they know where they, where the lead service lines are, they're going to use this opportunity to get as, rid of as many of them as possible in as quick a time as possible, because the testing component itself will take up a significant amount of time as the rule comes into effect. I don't know if we mentioned it, but you know, this rule is currently set to come into effect in June of this year. Whether or not that ends up being the case is debatable, but there's kind of a 3-year built-in lag to come into compliance by the end of 2024. And there's a number of things that need to be done in that time that where it's kind of a serious time crunch for probably a lot of these utilities. So the ones that are going to be removing, that can remove the service lines as quickly as possible, will probably have incentive to do that now. So the removal is certainly going to be a large part, particularly if we have this money directed specifically towards this goal. There's going to be a lot of holes being dug in the next several years, sure.
So the way I think we see it, or when we released a report on sort of the overall market sizing, if I recall, it was, you know, each replacement, it would range from $2,000 to $5,000. I mean, it adds up pretty quickly. But I think, and as I was speaking to a large EPC engineering construction company just earlier this week, we were talking about the American Jobs Plan, but in lead, and their point was, look, it's not a big kit opportunity. It's really, it's a lot of plumbers. It's a lot of like, go out there, fix a small job. It's just the volume is massive. And that's, I think, where some engineering firms or companies are targeting. They're sort of seem to be circling it so they can go to the cities, or at least set the wheels in motion with a plan. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, I think that sounds kind of in line with what I'm seeing on my side as well, that there's a lot of utilities that are now kind of faced with some challenges they're not particularly used to in terms of kind of the information management component of things and really just kind of the urgency. So there's going to be a lot of activity to sort of address this problem amongst a number of different companies in this space, probably in the next several years, and with the funding being dedicated to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes sense. Moving towards wrapping it up, I think in a nutshell, we're looking at, hey, you've got to do testing, you got to sort of understand monitoring, understand the problem. And there are newer technologies, companies out there. I mentioned 120 Water and Blue Conduit as examples. Like, they're capturing the data, analyzing it, and sort of clarifying the problem. The next step is there a program management piece of that, or those EPCs or the utility itself, where they kind of have to lay out the plan of action, how to deal with it and address it. And then lastly is sort of the nuts and bolts. Who's going to go dig the holes, replace the pipes, and deal with that? And that's where I suspect where the jobs come into play. And I would imagine this is going to take place. It's going to take better part of a decade, if not longer, to deal with this. It's not a fast process.
Yeah, I think that is right on. I mean, the original lead and copper rule was promulgated in 1991. So it's not, you know, something that's, you know, immediately being put into place as we need to do this now. I think that, you know, kind of to your point from the original part of our conversation here, is there seems to be, you know, hopefully an amount of political will, hopefully to get enough bipartisan agreement to address, you know, this particular problem. And with kind of the resources being put behind it and updates to that rule that was started in 1991, that there will probably be some acceleration in what happens in the next few years in terms of kind of the removal of lead service lines. But it's a problem that, yeah, will take many, many years to fully get rid of all lead service lines in the ground. I mean, it's been decades so far, and it'd probably be decades going forward, but some notable acceleration and probably quantity that will be removed overall the next 10 years as compared to the last 10 years, I guess we could probably say.
Do you think, and this, I guess, my final question for you, how much do you think Flint has to do with this? Like you said, you were saying, you know, 86, 91, you know, this has been in play for a long time. And, you know, once Flint happened, everybody seemed to think more about lead. They seemed to think a bit more about water quality. How much do you think that's had an impact?
I mean, I think from a political perspective, obviously Flint was a terrible situation that everybody can agree that, you know, it is an unacceptable situation to happen in anywhere in the country. So rhetorically speaking, it's a useful way to kind of approach the problem that we should all be able to agree that lead should not be in drinking water in the public in the US. So, and you know, to your point there around sort of the jobs that will emerge because of it, it's a good place to build support for a large infrastructure bill water component, I think, because it's something that everybody can kind of agree on is a major problem and needs to be remedied. So I can understand why it was used kind of centerpiece to talk about the water component of the infrastructure bill itself, and a good starting point to talk about water quality overall, because as we've been talking about, it's a very well-known problem. It's been around for a long time, and we know exactly what the effects of lead are on ingestion, particularly among younger folks and pregnant women, as opposed to sort of like, you know, PFAS. We know a fair amount of endocrine effects of some of the components, but we're really kind of early on in that sort of understanding the effects of PFAS and really even understanding how many PFAS particles there are. The number keeps going up. So it's a well-defined problem that we have kind of a general idea in terms of the scope of. And I think it makes sense in terms of the place to focus on as a center point for water quality going forward.
Also, there's a lot of litigation surrounding PFAS and who's responsible. And so you're right, that's still early stages in how it is going to be dealt with in whichever form. For lead, there's really no one to point a finger at, right? You know, it's kind of like, hey, it's all our problems. We're all responsible for this now. So now we just have to deal with it. And you're right. It's very definable. It's like, this is the problem. It's not shape-shifting over time. It's there. It's been there for a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, look, that was awesome, because when we talked about this as an idea for a podcast, I thought it was a good idea. And then we had a couple calls beforehand just to talk about, you know, what our thoughts are and perspectives. Yeah. So this has played out exactly how I had hoped. So with that, Greg, I will bid you farewell and thanks again. Be well, be safe.
Thanks, Reese.
All right. So yeah, for everybody else, all I ask is that you please subscribe, give us a review, please, please, please. It's not that hard. You can do it on Apple Podcasts. Can't do it on Spotify, and I don't blame you for listening to Spotify. Send us a note if you have any ideas or topics you'd like us to discuss. You can send it to waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com. And then you can always tell a friend about it. The pandemic's not over. You might as well reach out, say hi, and tell them, hey, I listen to the future of water. All right. This podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by Bluefield Research. To learn more about us and what we do and how we do it, you can visit our website, bluefieldresearch.com. Until later, everybody, take care. Talk soon.